Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, May 1st, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. Well, today, as we move through Contributors Week, we'll be talking with Jana Marie Smith, the pivotal figure in baseball history because of her work in designing ballparks and, by extension, impacting the collective experience of fans. She's working on Dodger Stadium daily now, just as she helped to create Camden Yards, the ballpark that changed thinking. She talks about the influence of a Hall of Famer along the way. But before we hear from her and Todd Radom with our weekly quiz, a couple of notes. The Little League World Series will not be played this year for the first time since the organization began because of the coronavirus pandemic. Little League International, which announced the move Thursday, also canceled regional tournaments and the championship tournaments in other Little League divisions, including softball, but said the events would return in 2021. The sports world will lose an estimated $12 billion due to the coronavirus. That's an estimate that was from an analysis conducted for ESPN. The $12 billion sum comes from major sports leagues losing $5.5 billion in revenue, college sports losing $3.9 billion, and youth sports losing $2.4 billion. Those figures are considered a conservative estimate as they do not include either pro or college football. If those sports are affected, the money lost could double. The revenue loss factors in everything from ticket prices to concession purchases to youth sports tournaments. Before we get to Jana Marie Smith and Todd, there is a terrific episode of ESPN Daily in your feed if you haven't already checked it out. Collecting baseball cards is a cherished pastime. ESPN baseball writer Sam Miller first got hooked on the game by studying the backs of cards growing up. And when he learned about a Don Mattingly card with a curious factoid about the star's alleged birth date, Miller began a quest to uncover the truth. When was Yankee star Don Mattingly born? Did this one baseball card have the inside scoop or a crucial error? Miller tells us how he solved a mystery long buried in one sentence. You can listen to that in your Baseball Tonight feed or subscribe to ESPN Daily wherever you listen to your podcasts. Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. And Todd, been looking forward to this interview with Jana Marie Smith today. And I know that you feel like she is a Hall of Famer.
Yes, Buster. Jana Marie Smith, to me, changed the way that we look at baseball. Now, that's a big, big, big statement, but I really believe it to be true, and I've thought about it for a long time. Think of our stadium experiences for those of us, certainly, who are our age, you and I, again, exact contemporaries. Ballpark experiences up until Camden Yards, the Big Bang, the thing that changed everything, they were really drab affairs. Jana Marie Smith is really responsible for the urban movement when it comes to ballparks. You know, there's a more human element to all of it. And finally, I can't help but think, you know, I remember, and again, I'm a visual guy, obviously a graphic designer, doing things on a different plane. But, you know, the first time I've been to Falling Water, Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpiece in Western Pennsylvania, I've been there a couple of times. And the thing that immediately struck me about Falling Water was the fact that everything in a Frank Lloyd Wright house is designed. Light switches, outlet plugs, the way that furniture interacts with the walls, and certainly famously with regard to Falling Water, the way that the building itself opens itself up to nature. Camden Yards opens itself up to this streetscape, this vibrant, organic streetscape. And I think that when we talk about contributors this week, there really should be a place for her and people like her in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
I totally agree. We taped our interview with her last night, Todd, and it really struck me. And Taylor, if you want to jump in here, too, see if you agree with me. As she talked about Camden Yards and what they were visualizing, it reminded me so much of you in the way that you talk about the work that you do, which I know I shouldn't be surprised by that, but it was astounding to me the way that both of you talk about what you see in front of you.
Well, you know, I could relate it to something that neither of us, I don't think she is involved with, and that is people who make music. especially people who have made music for a long time at a very high level. I will throw a total curveball into the conversation and say that, you know, in talking with Ice Cube, who I work with, who understands visuals, the guy studied architectural drafting in college for a year before he hit big with NWA. We talk about chopping it up, beating it out, getting the details right, pushing it beyond a certain limit, and then pulling it back. And I don't think it's any different in music, architecture, painting, design. I think it all comes from the same place.
You will love this interview, Todd, I'm telling you, coming up here in a minute. Her work, as she's going to discuss, it currently is on Dodger Stadium. We decided, you know what, let's talk about Dodger Stadium this week. What do you got?
Dodger Stadium, Buster, an absolute jewel. First of all, I would be remiss if I did not give a shout out to my pal Ross Yoshida at the Dodgers, who is a huge fan of the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And with him, I am very lucky to have visited every nook and cranny of this place, from the dugouts to the booth where Dodger organist Dieter Ruhl holds forth. The place is just unbelievable. It's a specimen of mid-century modern architecture. It's incredibly unique. And what do we keep coming back to in these conversations? Ballparks that have a defined sense of place really stand out. I cannot think, Buster, of a more super defined sense of place than Dodger Stadium. You think about it, for those of us who've been lucky enough to be there, if you haven't been there, you need to plan a trip when we're able to leave the house and we have games. But the lush landscaping, those beautiful crenellated, you know, zigzag roof lines, scoreboards, and that very singular signature color scheme. I'm an East Coast guy, but all of this just screams LA for me.
I'm biased in this conversation, Todd, because I, you know, grew up a Dodger fan. And so when I got to go to Dodger Stadium for the first time in 1991 with my former San Diego Union colleague, Ed Graney, it was a very emotional experience to walk through the gates. I remember we had seats that were sort of on the first base side. But to, you know, see the field and to take that in, that was so cool. I remember going through the first time. And as I talked about earlier in the week, I had to have a Dodger dog because I'd always heard about Dodger dogs. And, you know, that was the best tasting hot dog I've ever had. It really is a cool place. Now, I will tell you from the perspective of a broadcaster, it's not an easy place to work. You know, the clubhouses, you know, generally are smaller than other ones, although the redesigns in recent years, the reconstruction have certainly made that a lot better than it was before. Getting up and down from, you know, the top to the bottom is not an easy thing. Getting in and out remains. Traffic is traffic in L.A., right? It is a beautiful place.
Yeah, and you talk about, I think, the renovations that have been done in anticipation for, you know, what was supposed to be, I suppose, although it's not official, this year's All-Star game. More elevators, but that one elevator, very, very long ride. And, Buster, we would be remiss if we didn't hit on a couple of other things briefly about Dodger Stadium. I mean, the views, right? The San Gabriel Mountains out there beyond the outfield. And then behind home plate, those incredible views, the sparkling lights of downtown L.A. It is gigantic. It's MLB's biggest stadium. It is built on something like 300 acres, which is just, you know, it's incomprehensible to a fan who might have be conversant with Fenway Park, to name a name. Target Field, which is built on a tiny little spit of land. And the last thing for me, you know, anytime I have ever been there, especially on a summer night, a beautiful summer night, I can't help but think of the words of Vin Scully and his description of a cotton candy sky with a canopy of blue, and it looks good enough to eat.
That's absolutely perfect. You mentioned the slowest elevator in the world. A few years ago, I was riding that slow elevator after a game, and I, you know, was sort of locked in, game face on, trying to think about what I was going to write. And I just glanced to my left, and right at my left elbow was Reese Witherspoon. You're not going to have a lot of ballparks where you're going to run into actors and actresses the way that you do at Dodger Stadium, which is always a cool part of being there. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. We go from the beautiful to the ugly. This team did not record a winning season in the decade of the 2010s, and that is 2010 to 2019. Is it the White Sox, the Padres, the Marlins, or the Orioles? Did not record a winning season in the decade having just ended. White Sox, Padres, Marlins, or Orioles?
All right, go ahead, Taylor.
Let's go Marlins, the fish from Miami.
It is the San Diego Padres.
Damn it.
Taylor, you win.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
busted
wow.
through me. The confidence.
San Diego Padres, everything seems like dog years now, but they won 90 games in 2010.
Wow, some baseball guy you are, Buster.
Jeez. Nice job. Wow. Well, I think it's maybe, yeah, my brain, I was probably confusing the streak of years that have passed now since they actually made the postseason. So my dad, nice job, Taylor. Way to win that one.
Yes, I'm hot.
Very. We're coming for you next week.
There we go. All right, Todd, thank you and enjoy the interview with Janet Marie Smith.
I cannot wait, Buster. Thank you so much, guys. It was great being with you.
Janet Marie Smith is the Senior Vice President of Planning and Development with the Los Angeles Dodgers. She is well known for work on Camden Yards, the park which changed and augmented the experience for fans in Baltimore and many other cities to follow. Janet worked for the Orioles from 1989 to 1994 as Vice President of Planning and Development. Thanks for joining us. I mentioned you're working for the Dodgers now. How are your days spent at this time when baseball is basically shut down?
Well, we're not shut down. We had a huge $100 million renovation of Dodger Stadium underway, and we were barreling toward opening day on March the 26th and then got the call on March the 12th that the season was first postponed for 2 weeks and, of course, then indefinitely. So we slowed construction, but we didn't stop. And so every morning I come in at sunrise and leave at sundown just nursing this project to the finish line. And it looks spectacular, but boy, is it disappointing only being able to share it with, you know, 100 other construction workers that come in every day, and Stan Kasten, who's always here checking out and making sure that we're going to be ready whenever it's time to play ball again.
Okay, what parts have you been working on? Because as you did with your project at Fenway, it went sort of in sequence with every offseason you work on a different part. For 2020, yeah. What were the parts you worked on?
Our focus this year has been on the center field, renovating the outfield pavilions and that classic folded roof that has defined Dodger Stadium since 1962. The one part of this park that wasn't nearly as beautiful as everything else was the batter's eye, which was scaffolding wrapped in this black tarp and just a black tarp for the batter's eye. So we have redone that, and hopefully fans will feel that we've improved not only the look, but the cool thing about it is now you can go on top of the batter's eye and there's a bar up there and it looks both ways. And it just takes such fabulous advantage of not only the views of Dodger Stadium itself, but of the beautiful hillside of Elysian Park that surrounds us.
So in getting ready for this interview, I was reading up on you and I found something which I had not seen before, which sort of detailed how you got to know and became friends with Frank Robinson, the Hall of Famer who passed away last year. That, you know, I'm sure that your first connection with him was when you were working on the project in Baltimore. Can you just tell me a little bit about your friendship with him?
Yeah. Frank was manager in 1989 when I went to work for Larry Lucchino in Baltimore. And, of course, you know, he's Frank Robinson. Like, what else can you say? But when we started designing Camden Yards and really focusing on how to achieve Larry Lucchino's vision of making this an old-fashioned ballpark with modern amenities, what better resource was there than right there, you know, in the clubhouse with Frank Robinson? And Frank took a very sincere interest in this, a very vested interest in what Camden Yards was going to be, and really just gave it a lot of input into not just the field dimensions, the foul territory, the fence heights, all the things that you might expect someone to care about from the baseball side, but he could also speak with credibility in a way that no one else amongst us could about about this whole idea of a unique ballpark and taking advantage of the fact that baseball does not have any required dimensions except the infield, and that each park being unique meant something to the city, to the fans, and to players. And so, you know, it's one thing for, you know, for Larry Lucchino to speak about this vision and what he was hoping to achieve in Baltimore. It was a whole other thing for someone with Frank's credibility to speak to it. And it's really, you have to kind of roll back the clock in time and think about what was, you know, where America was in 1988. You know, round parks were still the norm. It was baseball and football sharing those venues. Kansas City had broken the mold when they built, two parks and they sat side by side. And Larry was looking to really push the envelope with this. You know, the Colts had left Baltimore, and so even though there had been talk about a new multi-purpose stadium on the site that we now know as Camden Yards, Larry was able to convince the state legislature that there was no reason to do a multi-purpose stadium with no football team sitting at the table, and that Kansas City was a better model. But he really wanted to take advantage of this urban site. And our governor, William Donald Schaefer, who had been the former mayor of Baltimore, he loved the city like nobody's business, and he really loved the fact that this was going to be right downtown. So the whole idea really worked, you know, to nestle into the urban fabric and let the streets dictate the outfield dimensions and use the warehouse, which, you know, took some doing to say, but that's another story. But to, you know, the whole idea was like, okay, let's, if we want it to be like an old fashioned ballpark, let's not make it Disneyland. Let's make it something authentic and real for Baltimore. And so Frank diving into that and really taking ownership of that, not only materially shaped the design of Camden Yards, but it just also ended up being a decades long friendship for me. And I valued as he moved through his career that he would often call me to look at something, whatever, you know, when he was at MLB, he oversaw the urban academies. And there were several times that I went to look at an academy and give him feedback on things that could be done to improve that and way kids could resonate with it. And so, yeah, that's that.
Now, I read a speech that you gave, and you talked about Frank, and you absolutely nailed him. I covered the Orioles for 2 years, and I got to know him at that time. You talked about what a softy he was, really, at heart, despite the fact he had this reputation as being one of the toughest guys of his generation. And you know better than I do, he had this very wry sense of humor. And so I'm curious about the first time that you had a chance to pick his brain about ballparks and how that came up as you guys began to develop this conversation.
Well, listen, he dove right in. You know, he was not one to be shy. So when I first started working on this, you know, this was my first time in sports, and that was, you know, that my credentials were that I had worked on major urban projects before, and I had always managed them. I do have a degree in architecture and planning, but I had always been responsible for putting together the team and really leading how the direction these projects would take. And I think Larry Lucchino felt that he had in HOK Sport a very competent sports architect, but he was desirous of having more than just, as he put it at the time, Kansas City with bricks. And so he hired me intentionally looking to kind of stir things up, that he didn't want it to just be the formula. And so when I, you know, we landed the job and kind of dove in, I can remember the first time that I was asked to present the plans as they were unfolding to the clubhouse. And as I remember, it was both the manager, coaches, and players all at once. And I told Roland Heeman, who was our general manager, I said, I'm really nervous. I said, I feel so kind of sheepish, you know, presenting this this design that we had worked out with HOK, and it was very much in its infancy. to players, what could I possibly know that they don't know? And Roland's advice was so solid. He said, he said, you know what you know, and it's not what they know. He said, they're all incredible athletes and they're going to look at how it impacts them, but don't think for a minute they grew up thinking about ballparks the way that you have, much less dissecting them and thinking about either how they might fit into the city or the way that we had at that by then studied all these old parks and tried to quantify, well, what was it that made a Fenway, a Wrigley, an Ebbets? You know, Ebbets was long gone and people were still talking about it. Like, what made that memorable? And I had really, by that time, studied it, and I mean that sort of in every sense of the word, studied it. This was long before there were, you know, coffee table books with ballparks and the kind of chatter you hear about it today. Back then, Green Cathedrals was one of the few bound volumes of any baseball book out there. So, I had turned to John Pastier, who was a former architecture critic at the Herald Examiner and a friend from when I had lived in Los Angeles, and he really had loved ballparks, loved thinking about the architecture, and had this incredible collection of postcards and imagery that he collected in a way that was very studied, and we brought him in to work with us. So, you know, I had literally done these scrapbooks that were like pictures of other ballparks and notes on what made them special. And Roland helped me realize that was not the way players thought of it. And yet, when I presented to the clubhouse, you know, while a few of them had questions, how high is the fence? What's the foul territory? You know, Frank was all in. He was all in and all over it. And he tells he's still alive in my mind. I can't use the past tense yet. You know, he tells these very, very funny stories that are always at my expense about it. He's like, Janet Marie, you can't do that. Like, that's a bandbox. We can't have that. And he was always right. And he understood that we were striving for an asymmetrical ballpark, but he was damned if it wasn't going to be a fair ballpark. You know, he didn't want to see it favor lefties over righties. He didn't want to see it favor pitchers over hitters. I mean, he was all about it playing fair, but he understood the uniqueness. And so he, of course, you know, he played in Crosby and he could speak about what it was like to run on this crazy incline in the outfield and how you came to master something as a player when your park was unique and it immediately gave you this home field advantage because you knew something that you knew something because you'd played in that park half the season. And he would also speak about the fans, about how the energy that he derived from fans, like how many fans probably were turned a cold shoulder by Frank Robinson, but there he is talking about the energy that he drew from them. So that was just always amazing to me how he was as tough as they could be, and he would always always give you a lot of grief about perfection, but he thought about everything, and he expected those around him to strive for the same kind of perfection.
The last time I talked to you, you said that during the as you began the process, Larry Lucchino said that in so many words that the word concrete was an ugly word and would not be accepted, which I always found it'd be absolutely apropos considering where you guys wound up.
That whole business about the materials are something that we almost take for granted today. So I love that you remember that quote, because one of the biggest issues we faced in designing this park was what was the superstructure going to be built of? And we felt passionately that it should be not just steel, but steel trusses. And if you looked at these older parks, they were in the classic era, the 1910s and 20s, they were these beautiful steel trusses, and the color was something that was special, and the lattice work of this structure was always something that was so beautiful. And once concrete became in favor, they just had this hulking heaviness to them that you couldn't escape. And yet the state was very concerned, as they should be, as they were managing the budget and the schedule for this. They were very worried that we were out on a lark to do something for the sake of design that could be done more efficiently and cost effectively with the concrete. But one of the advantages of an urban site is you can't just go right in and mow it down and start building. And so the Maryland Stadium Authority, led by Herb Elgrad and Bruce Hoffman, really had to figure out how to move businesses out and how to clear that site. And of course, we had the whole debate about the warehouse and could we justify saving it? Was the ballpark going to fit if we saved it? And it gave us time to have a learned debate instead of just a debate about doing steel versus concrete. And I love that sitting here, 28 years after Camden Yards opened, I don't think a single baseball park has opened that wasn't constructed out of steel trusses. It has become one of the defining features of virtually every park since.
Was there anywhere, because certainly now, I mean, it has a special place in baseball history. What you and Larry and other folks created is a pivot point in fan experience in baseball. But was there ever a point as the holes being dug and the trusses are being put up where you're like, what are we doing? Or was it all along, each day as each element's put in, you're like, yes, this is what we envisioned?
Well, I got to tell you, it's a good question, Buster. I think as much confidence as I had in the team that we were working with and in the power of Larry's idea and in the beauty of the execution, I held my breath for 3 years solid. And I can remember, even after the exhibition game, not willing to exhale. It wasn't until after the first opening day in 1992, when that game was over and the last out had been caught, that I exhaled and I couldn't wait to see Larry afterwards. And I just remember saying, it played a legit 9-inning game. Like everyone else is all gaga over the shutout and Rick Sutcliffe and the fact that traffic cleared and all these things. And all I could think of was that was an actual 9-inning game in the books. And it was just beautiful to watch. It was, everything that Governor Schaefer had hoped, with it being nestled into the city and taking advantage of the MART train that went to Washington and the light rail system and using the parking garages that were already there. The dollars that went into our infrastructure were next to nothing. The ballpark itself was just such a picture perfect day, and the sun glistening off of the warehouse and the ornamentation that David Ashton, our graphic designer, had added to the scoreboard and the flag court with all the team's flags flying, and just, you know, everything we had wanted it to be. Because you have to remember, we were leaving Memorial Stadium, which, yeah, it might have been a dump, but it was a dump that our fans loved. Like, Oriole fans love that. And think about the world championships that had been won there. And the memories we were leaving, and there were aspects of Memorial Stadium we took with us, most notably the 7-foot-high fence. You know, back in 89, eight-foot-high fences were the norm in baseball because of these multi-purpose stadiums and the fact that you had to squeeze, you know, football in there half of the time. And we really wanted to carry that 7-foot-high fence downtown with us, because the idea of an outfielder robbing a home run, that was a signature play in Baltimore. That was something that our fans loved. And I can remember, having to go to the league and get special permission for that. And we had, a very short dimension, actually down the lines. It kind of cut out quickly, but we asked for permission to take that 309 with us, and we literally brought the foul pole with us, and we literally brought home plate with us. But we wanted this park to tell a story about Orioles baseball and a story about Baltimore. And so the idea of having the seat in standard with the 1890s logo and this, putting up the flags of, you know, every team at the descending order of their standing every day, and the bullpens being stacked so you could see whoever was warming up for either team, were just all things that we felt were important to telling the story of baseball. And baseball is a sport that has a lot of leisurely time, and the banter between fans is part of the joy. And we wanted to give them something to talk about, you know, not only the game in front of them, but we wanted everything to have a meaning. It wasn't meant to just be architecturally correct or graphically appealing. It was meant to tell a story. And I guess we felt that that story had been told.
You're right about Memorial Stadium. I cannot watch the video that I have of the final game played there and the post-game ceremonies without weeping. I'm getting emotional thinking about it now, especially my, you know, old friend Mike Flanagan, who got to throw the last pitch for the Orioles there. What was an emotional moment for you as Camden Yards opened?
Well, you can't beat opening day, right? Opening day was just, it was so special. And it was, it was just so special. And I think every baseball game is special. I think, you know, everybody's got a story, but I think, the most validating thing for me is the feedback from fans. And I think sometimes my husband would say that working in baseball has sort of ruined my ability to sit through a game, because I am always up wandering around, especially if it's a park that I'm responsible for, thinking about fans' reactions and what are they doing and how are they watching the game. And that's something that's really changed since I first started working in baseball. You know, it was, when we opened Camden Yards, we were so proud of the fact that we had a scoreboard that was devoted to having all the out-of-town scores up all the time and not disappearing on you. And I can remember intentionally placing our vendors that sold the game day program at each entrance so that you could grab that scorecard and number two pencil on your way in. And, you know, we don't do that anymore. One of the things about Camden Yards that was so special that's not spoken about very often is the formula for baseball parks has always been, well, the best seats are between the foul poles, and the outfield was sort of leftover. It was just like leftover. And we were in a funny situation in Baltimore where getting the third baseline due north, where you get the best sun conditions on the playing field, put home plate furthest away from all of our mass transit and the bulk of the downtown parking. Now, what it gave us was this beautiful picturesque skyline so that we were able to design the ballpark with the field in the foreground and then the scoreboard and warehouse sort of in the midground and like a stage set. Then you had the skyline. And but the question was, how are we going to handle the entryway being at what arguably was considered the back door? And one of the things I really enjoyed about working with RTKL, who did our master plan and was a part of the HOK sports team, is that they really helped us, you know, bang the drum on the cityscape and making certain that our fans felt that the approach to the ballpark and entering from the outfield, that when you cross that turnstile, never mind that you might still have another 1,000 feet to go to get to your seat, you were in the action. You were part of the whole experience and the excitement. And so the whole idea of Utah Street, spelled as only Baltimore can with
yeah.
E, was about creating, you know, this energy. So as soon as you pass through the turnstiles, you were in the game. You could see the field. The vendors were there with their hot dogs and cold beer. And there was the music from, coming from the sound system, and you could see a batting practice immediately, and you know, all these things that went into thinking about what Utah Street was. And it was just so, it was so energizing to see that our fans absolutely responded to that. Nobody complained how far it was to get to their seat. And I was almost amused, you know, in the following years when I would hear, other clubs talk about wanting to create a quote outfield experience, because we weren't looking to create an outfield experience. Like, we were trying to legit turn lemon into lemonade. And, yet it worked. And sort of, you know, just to tie all this together, you know, what did Stan Kasten have us do at Dodger Stadium this year? It was to say, look, the outfield is cool. Like, this, the outfield is not left over anymore. Like, it totally, in the last 30 years, fans have flocked it, to do a 360 around a baseball park, with the outfield being arguably as big a magnet as being behind home plate. And that's where, you know, even here at Dodger Stadium, we've placed our energy this year.
We got a few minutes left. I want to ask you about, because, again, doing the research for the interview, you think about your background. You're from Mississippi. I don't think a lot of people would necessarily think that someone who's had so much influence on ballparks in America would come from Mississippi. But I got some insight into your background more when I asked you before we started about your name and what you preferred to be called. And you noted that each of the, you know, your three, Janet Marie Smith, all have five letters, and it was part of your father's design. Tell me about that and how your background came up that you got into architecture.
Well, my dad's an architect, so that, we can just keep it short. There's that. But there's more than that, of course. My dad was an architect, and my mom worked full time the whole time I was growing up too. And I always think that's noteworthy, because the other question I get asked all the time is about being a woman. And you know, my role model was my mother, who was working all the time. So my dad, he did have this great design sense, and my sister and I both. Our names are each five letters, so there is a perfect balance and symmetry to our names, and that was not an accident in my dad's mind. So, so if I carry the Janet Marie a lot, it is as much a tribute to my dad, who loved baseball. And, you know, in Mississippi, if you grew up with the radio, you were a Cardinals fan, and if you grew up with television, you were a Braves fan. And I sort of loved being surrounded by both. And when I went to architecture school at Mississippi State, we were in this great old former dairy judging pavilion out on the edge of campus, because the architecture school was fairly new at the time, and that's where they chose to put us. But we were pretty happy over there, because when we needed a break from studio, we would just roll out to Duty Noble Field and watch some baseball. So I think that's kind of been lurking in there somewhere. It wasn't. It was really the idea of building Camden Yards in the middle of a city and being of an urban environment that attracted me to apply for the position working for Larry Lucchino. But I don't think I would have had that baseball in my blood without either my dad's influence or being next to such a storied baseball field as the one at Mississippi State.
Were you able to tour Camden Yards for your parents?
Absolutely.
How much fun was that? That must have been such a blast for you.
I think it was fabulous. Absolutely. No, absolutely. My dad came several times. My parents even made sure they were there for when Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's streak, which was just a magical moment. And it was wonderful to be able to share that with them.
All right. Well, Janet Marie, Roland Heeman, you mentioned he was the 2011 Buck O'Neill Award winner. And I hope there is a day when you are given the Buck O'Neill Award at the Baseball's Hall of Fame, because you certainly deserve it. And I really appreciate your time and you helping to distract us.
Well, I hope we get 56,000 fans back to Dodger Stadium this summer. It's just we miss all of you. It's all these ballparks are just waiting to host baseball again. Us too.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. an interesting version of Bleacher Tweets here. First up, we got a question from Savage and the Beast at Savage and Beast. And Savage wrote in, you know, basically being like, what's the criteria for Bleacher Tweets? I keep sending this tweet in with a question, hasn't made it on the show. Really no criteria for Bleacher Tweets, although I will say, I mean, I read all of them. So, you know, if you're asking the same question over and over again and we don't put it on, maybe mix it up a little bit. That's all I'm saying. Not that it's a bad question, but we're not going for it. It's okay. But because Savage has been persistent, we will ask this one today. So Savage writes in, with your discussion with Hembo Wednesday, it got me thinking, do you think the Hall of Fame would ever do a Hall of Infamy for players like Rose, Shoeless Joe, and those from the steroid era? If not, why? I can think of many reasons why, but Buster, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the Hall of Fame, I think, isn't going to like create a place where they're going to dump on players.
The bad guy wing.
They don't run from the history. They don't run from history. Like, you can find all the information you want about the Black Sox, about Pete Rose. There's the display there about the steroid era. So they don't run from it. But I also don't think they necessarily want to just specifically target individual players. Oh, by the way, Taylor, I love the fact that you're like the gatekeeper, you know? you're just like, no Bleacher Tweet allowed here. Yes, you're allowed in. I could see you outside an exclusive club being like a bodyguard, pointing at the various Bleacher Tweets that are allowed in.
As my fellow producers at ESPN say, my power starts and stops inside the studio, and I will wield that in here as much as I can. So, apologies if your questions don't make the cut, but I like most of them. We do get most of them on the air. If you look through all of them, you will see, I would bet that like 70 to 75%, make the show. So keep,
you know what,
plugging
though?
Away.
I might complicate that for you and make it, if I send out some tweets and ask for Bleacher Tweets, you will get a bunch of questions.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'm going to make you like go through them and be selective and be that bully guard out front of the club.
That's totally fine. I'm into that. That's what I'm here for.
Okay.
Our friend Carlos Almighty writes in, who were some of the unlikeliest World Series winners of recent memory? Still surprised that the 03 Marlins pulled off what they did.
Yes and no on the 03 Marlins, because, man, they had some talent. You know, young Miguel Cabrera, young Josh Beckett, shoving in Yankee Stadium in game six the way that he did. I'll always, because I grew up a Dodger fan, my last year of real fandom was 88, and that Dodger team was probably the worst of the four teams and entered the playoffs. The fact that they won the World Series was remarkable, but they rode the backs of Oral Hershiser, Kirk Gibson. The 06 Cardinals, they finished the regular season 83-78. I remember writing at that time, what a scout said to me, they won't win a game in the playoffs. They finished poorly. They didn't have a lot going, and they went on and won the World Series. And then there was the 2014 Giants. They were the fifth seed in the National League. They had to go into Pittsburgh and win a wild card game. And that's when the legend of Madison Bumgarner's run in 2014 started. That team was 88-74 in the regular season. That was a pretty unlikely champion.
I love a good wild card team going in and taking the whole thing. That's yep. Always a lot of fun. At DSuds24 writes in, what team has the best theme song in your opinion? I'm thinking of songs like Meet the Mets, Indian Fever, OK Blue Jays, for example. I'm going to, because I'm the gatekeeper here, there is only one answer to this question.
The magic of Orioles baseball.
Really?
That's it. That's the answer.
Oh, my God. We actually did a few years ago. We had kind of like a playoff of team theme songs. OK. And Meet the Mets is clearly the winner. That one you just highlighted there. That's awful.
Yeah, it's terrible.
By the way, I just being in the ballpark for OK Blue Jays, I hated that song.
Mm.
You know, I couldn't. At some point, we're going to have my old friend Dan Shulman on. Who's broadcast game now for the Toronto Blue Jays as well as for ESPN. And we're going to get some background on that song.
Sounds good to me. Last one here, David Parker at Parker David 1962. He writes in, a little light reading for you. Looking forward to further dandelion salad recipes on the next Dandelions Tonight podcast. He sent us a post from northernwoodlands.org. Titled Dandelions Make Salad Not War with Lawn Invaders. And here's a quick excerpt from that post. They're good steamed, sauteed, or simply blanched in hot water and drained. Dandelion leaves make healthful salad. Yellow flower heads can be used to make wine. The taproot can be harvested for food to make a coffee-like beverage. The dandelion's value on the menu is evidenced by the fact that plant breeders have developed cultivators with bigger leaves. Self-blanching takes out the bitterness. Are we going to see any dandelion salad on the only household table at any point? Should I eat some on the podcast for a bit? What are your thoughts on this?
You know, I'm going to have to think about that. I actually reached out, David, when I saw your tweet this morning, I reached out to my two sisters who are excellent cooks, and my younger sister, Amelia, is a vegetarian, and I wanted to get some feedback on dandelions, and I did not get anything back, but I'm a little bit intrigued because every day now I'm throwing out 100 dandelions, okay? So if there's some potential there, maybe I'll work it out.
Maybe even just a little bit of garnish or something. Who knows?
There you go.
That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Thanks for all the tweets, everyone. Keep them coming. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter.
And before we go, we got a great week lined up for you next week. On Monday, we're going to be speaking with former president of the Hall of Fame, Jeff Idelson. On Tuesday, in what we're going to call MVP week, Marcus Semien of the Oakland Athletics will join us. He's got a lot of stories. Ricky Henderson, Ron Washington. And we're going to have a lot of conversation about another MVP late in the week. I'm not going to tell you who, but it's going to be a lot of fun. That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Janet Marie Smith, to Todd Radom, and to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.